You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
G'day, Annie McLaughlin here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, workers' stories and social justice issues. This program is produced in Naarm, or Melbourne, for 3CR and broadcast across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Today we go to the Eco-Socialist Conference held in Naarm on the 6th to the 7th of September at Ballum Ballum. We will hear from Giselle Hanna, a former presenter on Stick Together, who is now the Victorian Secretary of the CPSU in a members-led win against an incumbent of 30 years standing. The session Giselle is part of is called Organising Workers in Today's Economy. But first, some union news. The Workers' Guardian Weekly reports that grain terminal workers at CBH's Kwinana Terminal have been locked out of their workplace by their employer in response to a cost of living wage claim. Maritime Union of Australia, the MUA, and the Electrical Trades Union, the ETU, members from the CBH grain terminal, Rockhampton in Western Australia, were told at 8:30pm on a Sunday night, the 7th of September, to not attend their shift at 5:30am Monday morning. The lockout of the entire workforce of 130 workers at the grain terminal came in response to 24 maintenance workers implementing rolling stoppages over 5 days after being informed that they would be paid only 9% of their salary for a full day's work, where they only refused to do isolations. Isolations represent less than 10% of their work in any normal workday. MUA members have been bargaining in good faith with the grain exporting giant since March this year, asking for a modest raise in wages of 6% per year. In response, CBH have offered a sub-inflation 2.5% increase despite a bumper grain season. CBH recorded a $73.8 million surplus last financial year. MUA WA Branch Secretary Will Tracy said it was unconscionable to strip away people's income with less than 10 hours' notice during a cost-of-living crisis. This is an extremely aggressive act of provocation by CBH, especially coming on the back of stripping 91% of maintenance workers' income when they perform bands representing less than 10% of the work they do on any normal day. Locking out the entire workforce of 130 workers off the back of 24 maintenance workers refusing to work when their pay has been cut by over 90% represents the worst of corporate bastardry, Tracy said. The workers at CBH have gone above and beyond to support the farming communities in getting their grain out to our export partners, and this is how they're treated in response to a modest wage increase request and a refusal to work basically for free. It's clear that the industrial relations landscape favours the employers in this instance, and yes, we know it's a strategy that CBH is legal right, but is it moral? Is it ethical? Is it fair? Locking an entire workforce of 130 out of their workplace because 24 maintenance workers refused to work for almost nothing is offensive and wrong, he said. The New South Wales Public Service Association has congratulated all art gallery staff who walked out during lunch on the 27th of August in protest of announced $7.5 million funding cuts and 51 job cuts Taking action during such uncertain times takes courage. When we stand together, we are strong, said the PSA. The union also extended thanks to the many members from across the cultural sector who came out in support. We saw members from the State Library, Australian Museum, Museums of History, the Powerhouse, Create New South Wales and the Botanic Gardens join in. This is what union strength looks like, united across institutions. Staying in New South Wales, 300 jobs are to go at Water New South Wales, the latest in 1,515 job cuts across essential services that have been revealed recently. The 300 staff critical to floodplain mitigation, dam safety and water quality testing were told they would be joining the unemployment queues. This came on top of an announcement last week by the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development that 165 jobs would go, even though they are vital for natural disaster response and in controlling pests like fire ants and Varroa mite. In recent weeks, Transport for New South Wales also announced 950 jobs would go, and TAFE New South Wales announced it would be cutting 100 jobs from regional centres including Dubbo and Orange. Public Service Association General Secretary Stuart Little said regional communities will be without essential frontline workers if the cuts aren't reversed. These are researchers who provide safe drinking water to communities in Lismore and northern New South Wales during recent flood events, said Little. These are people who work in flood mitigation to try and protect communities from one in 100 flood events like we saw hit Ugroa in 2022. You can't cut jobs like this and expect it not to impact flood response or water quality. Australian Services Union New South Wales and ACT Secretary Angus McFarlane said the decision was devastating. It's outrageous that Water New South Wales is slashing hundreds of jobs at a time when their expertise and labour has never been more essential. The Australian Council of Trade Unions has welcomed the Senate's passage of the Albanese government's bill to protect penalty and overtime rates for Australian workers. The new provisions are meant to safeguard penalty and overtime rates as part of changes to the Fair Work Act. The passage of the bill means that large employer lobby groups can no longer seek to win so-called exemption rate clauses in modern awards, which pay employees a higher base rate of pay but scrap their penalty and overtime rates, leaving them worse off overall. The legislation follows recent attempts by big employer lobby groups to erode workers' overtime and penalty rates in the retail, administration, banking and finance sectors through application to the Fair Work Commission. Prior to the new legal protections, clerical workers stood to lose up to $7,000 a year in entitlements, and individual retail workers were at risk of being $5,000 a year out of pocket if employer group attempts were successful. With the sale of Fonterra Australia to French dairy juggernaut Lactalis looming, United Workers Union members, dairy workers at Fonterra's Bayswater site in Melbourne, walked off the job on Thursday and Friday, the 4th and 5th of September, as the standoff over improved paying conditions at the site intensifies. Fonterra Australia, valued at $4 billion, has so far failed to provide an updated offer since the first walkout on August the 22nd. United Workers Union members are pushing for a four-year agreement to give workers stability across a time of uncertainty with the company's looming sale. Members are also fighting for an increase to the redundancy payout by 8 weeks to 60 weeks, as well as work, health and safety improvements, including heavy lifting equipment, a heavy lifting allowance and chemical allowance. As it stands, Fonterra's current offer fails to address workers' concerns about insufficient redundancy payouts and urgent work, health and safety improvements needed by Bayswater workers. The two-day strike action saw over 80 workers walk off the Bayswater site in a resounding rejection of the company's current offer. United Workers Union members at Bayswater have reserved their right to take further protected industrial action unless an agreement is reached. SafetyNet reported on the 2nd of September that the Maritime Union of Australia has secured a historic agreement at Hutchinson's ports that locks in jobs, delivers big gains in wages and conditions, and slams the door on automation for the life of the deal. The agreement was struck without any industrial action being taken. Hutchinson Ports Australia operates international container terminals in Port Botany. That's Hutchinson Port Sydney and the Port of Brisbane, Hutchinson Ports Brisbane. MUA Deputy National Secretary Warren Smith said this is a clear victory for workers against the global push for automation as well as for the day-to-day lives of wharfies working at Hutchinson's. Smith noted that the Hutchinson's outcome lands at a time of escalating tensions with neighbouring terminal operator DP World, where members are staring down an automation push which will make no improvement to waterfront productivity. The MUA has committed to an all-of-union fight to stand up to DP World's productivity-reducing, job-destroying automation. DP World is pushing to replace human-driven straddle cranes in Brisbane and Melbourne ports, despite results showing slower, less accurate and less safe robotic cranes. This is a victory for every worker at Hutchinson and across the whole waterfront, as it will expose the productivity myth of automation, stevedoring companies who want to use job-destroying, ineffective, slow and unsafe automation experiments will end up behind in contracts, behind on productivity, and will not have a positive relationship with their workforce that can help lift productivity or build markets share, Smith said. Evidence from international container operations show that automated container terminals are not as productive as those employing high-skilled stevedores, are consistently slower and more expensive, and are less safe for workers. You're on Stick Together, worker stories, union news and social justice issues. Giselle Hanna, the new secretary of the Victorian branch of the CPSU, the Community and Public Sector Union, was part of a members group which beat the rusted-on incumbents at the most recent union election. Here she reflects on the win and what it means when organising workers in today's economy.
My talk today is called Meeting Workers Where They're At, and that is really the secret to our success, is how we won. And the reason I'm calling it Meeting Workers Where They're At is because since we've taken office, many, many comrades who have known me on the left for the last 25 years have an expectation that the union is going to be as radical and as left-wing as I am. And the reality is that that's not possible. So part of what I want to do today is explain how we built our movement, how we won, and then what the task is for the CPSU going forward. So the motivation, and you know, in the context of this conversation, which is organising workers in today's economy, I think one of the most important things to consider in that are, firstly, all of the amazing things that were just spoken about, which in my view is a sober analysis of why union power is so weak today. And actually starting the conversation from a sober analysis of that weakness versus what I'm going to describe as a fantasy of what workers' power is, versus an understanding and an appreciation of what workers' power could be if we do the work to build that. The other thing I want to kind of create as the context for this conversation is also the reality that the situation in the world is urgent. It's urgent and it's desperate, and we find ourselves in a situation where we don't have the structures, we don't have the politics, and we don't have the consciousness necessary to mount the fight that we need. So how do we get to where we want to be, understanding with honesty where we are today? So in that context, I'll explain where A Voice for Members came from and how we went from a conversation in a training day on the 5th of November 2024, so that was Melbourne Cup Day, to winning an election 7 months later. I've been a member of the CPSU for 11 years. I've been a public servant for that amount of time. In 11 years in the CPSU, there was not a single election. There was really no way to participate in the structures of that union. Participated in my union as an ASU, moved to the CPSU, and just find every single door was closed. I made the assessment that that was because I was viewed as a rabid lefty, that the secretary felt like that I would start organising against her and take over the union. I mean, the irony is that I did. It was never the plan. And quite frankly, that fear and paranoia, and fear and paranoia I think is a dominant theme in many union bureaucracies, but that fear and paranoia, it was really the undoing in the CPSU. So that was my experience, and I internalised and personalised it. It's a Giselle problem. And so I just kept gently working in my union. We were never given access to membership lists, right? I was a delegate. We were never enabled to organise membership in our own area. For me, just the complete opposite of what unionism is about and what organising is about. Mm-hmm. And if you've got this super dynamic delegate, why would you not want to use them and raise them and encourage them? So that was 10 years of being in this union, and I was active in a million other ways across the union movement, but not in my union. Then the war in Palestine happened, or the attack on Gaza happened. And internationally, these structures called Trade Unionists for Palestine emerged. Everywhere, not just in Victoria, but right across Australia, but actually right across the world. So Trade Unionists for Palestine in Australia sits in a global context. But what happened was all these people who were grief-stricken at what they were seeing came together, and then they were sent off to organise in their union groups. Now, Trade Unionists for Palestine is actually not union organising. It's people who call themselves unionists that are getting together to basically do something other than union organising. But what happened in my union was that for the first time in my 11 years, I met other CPSU members because I hadn't been able to before. And at some point, we all kind of found each other and started organising around Palestine. Our EBA was happening at the same time. We never voted on a log of claims. We never got to debate the issues that we would put up. Our union insisted on not challenging the government's 3% wage cap, and the members were outraged. But on this occasion, we had an opportunity to express our outrage with each other. And what we started to do was talk about voting our EBA down. Now, there were only 80 of us at this point. And at this point, I said, okay, well, let's create a rank and file group. We created a rank and file group. What I want to say about this is that Palestine was how we found each other. But the EBA is how we organised. Because actually, in order for a campaign to take hold and to grow, it needs three elements. It needs to be widely felt, deeply felt, and it needs to be seen as winnable. Our EBA, it was widely felt, deeply felt, and we believed it was winnable. We lost, though, but it was what brought us together. When we started organising, our union decided to start threatening us with misconduct. So what we did, well, what I did was I organised a planning day to train members in the rules of the union. so that members knew that we couldn't get kicked out, and to build the kind of solidarity needed for a genuine rank-and-file caucus in the CPSU. The intention was to build enough industrial strength and power so that in 4 years' time, we could properly pressure the leadership to consult on the log of claims, to consult on any industrial action we were willing or not willing to take, irrespective of what they were willing or not willing to do. The entire project was about working collaboratively within the union, applying pressure to the leadership. When we read the rules, we discovered there was an election. And so we raise a question, do we run or don't we? And then when the agreement was to run, the next question was, do we run tokenistically as a gesture to say union elections are good, or do we run for real with the intention of winning? We danced around this a million times. And then we decided we'd run for real. And I was still sceptical. But what I did was I looked at the structures of the union. I looked at our branch council. We had 7 vacancies on branch council. And out of the positions that were there, so everybody said prison officers were the incumbent's power base, and there was only one prison officer on that council. And I said, the power is a house of cards. If we blow, it'll fall, and that's what happened. Having made the decision to run for real is how we directed our demands and the platform on which we would run. Our membership is 2,000 prison officers and 13,000 others. In those others, a whole bunch of them are in the regional areas, working in farming communities, in agriculture, environmental organisation, lands, parks, etc. What we confronted was that even though we'd come out of Palestine, we were all a bunch of radicals, the membership wasn't. And we could not put an ultra-leftist platform to this membership if we were running for real. And we, as a result, revisited this question over and over and over. Do we run on Palestine? If we don't, like, is it for real? Is it not? And here is the reality. We did not run on free Palestine. We didn't run on that platform. We didn't run on internationalism. We didn't run on strikes. We didn't run on any of that. We ran on challenge the government's 3% wage cap. We met workers where they were at. We ran on workload issues and job cuts, because job cuts resulted in the leftover work being done by who remained in the workforce. We ran on democracy and transparency. Where is the union's money going and who decides? We ran on a restoration of the delegate structures within the union and an ability for members to be actively involved in their union. We met workers where they were at. And every time we knocked on doors, and our opposition kept trying to sell us as ultra-leftists and that we were going to spend all the union's money on Palestine and political folly and so on. And every time we spoke to workers, we said, these are the things that we're fighting for. And that is what they voted for. Which leads me to the next point, which is, what is the role now for member education? How do we get from where we are to where we want to be, given that, in fact, the leadership of this union is very, very left-wing, but the membership isn't? The truth is, it is a push-pull situation. I say the state of the world right now is this. We are in a state of capitalist crisis, and we are careering to war. And every time capitalism reaches this point of crisis, it seeks to resolve that through war. But capitalism fundamentally is an economic structure that requires infinite growth with finite resources. And that is fundamentally the contradiction in capitalism that cannot be resolved. And there is no predetermined outcome to the crisis. In relation to the advertisements for this conference and how Marx and Engels conclude the Communist Manifesto is that we are careering towards barbarism or socialism, and it's not predetermined. Socialism is not an automatic outcome of where we're going. We need to build it, and we need to build the political education and consciousness for that. So if you look at what is emerging, last Sunday with the fascist demonstrations, and those elements, those people, are actually workers too. Where they are is inside our unions. Pushing for ultra-leftist positions right now isn't necessarily what it's going to take to build workers' power. So how do we get from here to where we want to be? My opinion is meeting workers where they're at and linking the political issues with workers' material conditions. My view is that you would have halved Sunday's rally if you doubled the New Start allowance. That's it. You would have halved that rally on that question alone. So the suppression of wages and conditions, which creates the crisis, the cost of living crisis that people are experiencing, that forces the them, us, who is responsible for my conditions, and the only people that have an answer for that question are Donald Trump and the fascists and the right-wing elements. We need an answer for that question. That is what organising in this economic situation requires, in my view. So organising around workers' material conditions is the pathway to the political education, which is the pathway to building that leadership to push for a left-wing solution to this crisis. It's slow, patient, tedious, heartbreaking work. I put out a statement condemning the rallies on Sunday. I lost 20 members in the first day. That is my membership. I don't know, maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. I'm not prepared to call it either way. What I know is that we are really divided, and what is required is unity to fight back.
That's it for Stick Together this week. If you want to catch up with our program, the podcast is available at 3cr.org.au or at your favourite podcast site. You can contact the producers of the show at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com or by ringing 03 9419 8377 and leaving us a message. My name's Zani McLaughlin. Remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there is a union for you. And until next time, stick together.
This song was written by Mill Lampell, Lee Hayes, and yours truly, Peter Seeger, in the spring of 1941. That was the year that Henry Ford was being organized into the CIO. And Woody Guthrie had taught the three of us the old talking blues. You know, if you want to get to heaven, let me tell you what to do. Got to grease your feet in a little mutton stew. And I think Mill, it was, thought of paraphrasing that. And Lee added a verse, and I added a verse, and suddenly we had the song almost completed, except that we hadn't found any solution. All we'd done is add up the problems, that we hadn't found how to solve any of them. And about a month went by, and one day I was sitting up on the roof and realized that there was only one solution to it, the old one of Stick Together. So I made two verses to end it off, none of them rhymed. And that's how the song Talking Union was born. Now you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. Got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, won't be long. You got shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. Of course, it ain't quite that simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven, St. Peter will be the straw boss then, boys. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. Pass out a leaflet, call a meeting, talk it over. Speak your mind, decide to do something about it. Cause the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool. But you can always tell a stool, though, that's a fact. He's got a yellow streak running down his back. He doesn't have to stool, you know. He'll always make a good living on what he takes out of blind men's cups. Well, you got a union now. You're sitting pretty. Put some of the boys on the steering committee. The boss won't listen if one guy squawks, but he's got to listen if the union talks. He'd better. He'll be mighty lonely one of these days. Suppose he's working you so hard, it's just outrageous, paying you all starvation wages. You go to the boss would yell, "Before I raise your pay, I'd see you all in hell." Well, he's puffing a big cigar, feeling mighty slick, thinks he's got your union licked. He looks out the window and what does he see but 1,000 pickets, and they all agree he's a bastard. Unfair. Slave driver. Bet he beats his own wife. Now, boys, you come to the hardest time. The boss will try to bust your picket line. He'll call out the police, the National Guard, tell you it's a crime to have a union card. They'll raid your meeting, hit you on the head, call every one of you a goddamn red, young patriotic. Moscow agents, bomb throwers, even the kids. Well, out in Detroit, here's what they found. Down in Pittsburgh, here's what they found. Down in Bethlehem, here's what they found. Out in Frisco, here's what they found. That if you don't let red baiting break you up, if you don't let stool pigeons break you up, if you don't let race hatred break you up, if you don't let vigilantes break you up, you'll win. What I mean, take it easy, but take it.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.